We're looking at the story of Saul and covering the entire Old Testament. We wouldn't give a whole lot of time to Saul, except that he's pivotal in the monarchy. He represented, as you know, the first monarchy in Israel. Incidentally, there are people today looking toward reestablishing a monarchy in Israel. I get the Jerusalem Post. There is a pretty strong groundswell, we call it, of thought about restoring the monarchy. There's also a groundswell toward restoring the orthodoxy to Jerusalem, where they're not recognizing modernist priests, priests who are conservatives, as we would call them, which are moderate priests, versus the orthodox, which is the radical priest. And the monarchy may not be dead altogether yet, but it was God's second choice, as he did not originally want them to have a monarchy. A couple of weeks ago, we pointed out that he nevertheless did his best to find the best king that he could, and did not take his hand away from Israel, but via Samuel put something of the seal of his approval on it, and stayed with them, and blessed them greatly. And the first king, Saul, who had been drawn out of a lesser tribe, Benjamin was the youngest of the sons of Israel. And one of the interesting, or that's not a very good word, that's a too general a word, one of the unique and important features of the prophecies is that the younger will rule the elder. Of course, it was always the opposite way in the social structure of Israel. The eldest son always was the prominent one. Well, in God's economy, he seems to like to turn that around, where the older serves the younger. Some of them haven't found it out yet. In Psalm 68, David made a point of that in this famous psalm we've talked about in the past. It's a way of interpreting this. There's a verse here that was difficult to translate. I studied it quite a bit to really get the correct translation of it. Now, this is the prophecy concerning Israel's return to Jerusalem, the holy city. And in verse 26, as they're marching back to the holy city, the singers are going before the band. This is all perhaps figurative. It's very doubtful to me that Israel will march from Egypt into Jerusalem. It's a long hike. It's figurative, the marching back to Israel with the victory march and the singers. It says, they have seen thy goings, O God, even the goings of my God, my King, in the sanctuary. The singers went before, the players on instruments followed after. Among them were the damsels playing with timbrels. Actually, it was an order of march. Among them is not a good translation. The singers went before, and the instruments came behind, and in the middle, not spread out among them, but in the middle were the damsels with their timbrels. They're saying, bless ye God in the congregations, even the Lord from the fountain of Israel. Now, get this. There is little Benjamin, their ruler. Now, you see, this text says Benjamin with their ruler. They were chicken. They didn't want to say it. I didn't want to translate it straight because they didn't think it was appropriate that Benjamin should be their ruler, but that's what it is. So you'll see the word with in italic there, because it's not supposed to be there. There's little Benjamin, their ruler, the princes of Judah and their council, the princes of Zebulun and the princes of Naphtali. Now, in several of these songs, which we've talked about before and won't go into now, the same phrase occurs as you have here in the book of Samuel, where Saul is being set over the house of Israel, and he is a Benjamite. The connection is certain. There's no way you can avoid the implication of that. And that fits with God's general attitude toward the lesser lights really taking precedence over the so-called greater lights. Now, there's another person who is of the tribe of Benjamin. And who is that?
Paul.
Paul, right. Another Saul who became known as Paul. Very interesting. Quite an interesting connection. I wouldn't say that it was pushing it to say there was a connection. I mean, there was some kind of repetition here of God overturning the normal processes of society to accomplish his will. He seemed to enjoy doing that, if you can use the word enjoy relative to the deity one. I don't know that you can, but Samuel started out with quite a thrust, because he immediately took hold when there was an invasion of Israel, and even before Saul had been anointed king, people were sort of milling about, you know, and didn't seem to know what to do, and Saul said, let's get with it, we got to save our country. And so immediately he took hold of things. And in the early days, he was very, very zealous. And in fact, he became too zealous. He began really, I don't know, we'd say throwing his weight around, but he began putting forth strong ideas relative to what they ought to do. And he was getting sort of into the spiritual vein, and at one point he was asking them to fast, and this is an item I want to call your attention. So zealous was he that he made some rather radical requests, and one of them nearly got him in a trap, but the people were more level-headed than he, and that was a situation where he said in verse 24 of chapter 14, "And the men of Israel were distressed that day, for Saul had adjured the people, saying, Cursed be the man that eateth any food until evening, that I may be avenged on mine enemies. So none of the people tasted any food. And all of them, the land came to a wood, and all they of the land came to a wood, his hosts, his bands, warriors. And there was honey on the ground. And when the people were come into the wood, behold, the honey dropped, but no man put his hand to his mouth, for the people feared the oath." See, so Saul had given them a strong oath. Nobody's going to eat anything. Well, now these were fighting people. Now watch how this happens. "But Jonathan heard not when his father charged the people with the oath." See, Jonathan was quite a warrior in his own right, and he was out with his armor bearer engaged in battle. "And he came back. He had not heard, and so he put forth the end of the rod that was in his hand and dipped into the honeycomb and put his hand to his mouth, and his eyes were enlightened." If you want to get a quick lift, a tablespoon of honey will help you a lot. Sugar will do that because it goes immediately to the bloodstream. So Jonathan ate some of his honey, and he was refreshed and renewed. It says that his eyes were enlightened. "And then answered one of the people and said, Thy father straitly charged the people with an oath, saying, Cursed be the man that eateth any food this day. And the people were faint." That means they were very afraid here, because they liked Jonathan. Jonathan was a very engaging young man and a warrior and a sort of a hero, folk hero, I guess, or something. "And then said Jonathan, My father hath troubled the land, See, I pray you how mine eyes have been enlightened because I tasted a little of this honey. See, so it wasn't a miracle thing. It was just that that was the physical reaction. How much more if happily the people had eaten freely today of the spoil of their enemies which they found, for had there not been now a much greater slaughter among the Philistines? The people flew upon the spoil and took sheep and oxen and calves and slew them, and the people ate. Then they told Saul, saying, Behold, the people sin against the Lord in that they eat with blood. And he said, You have transgressed. Roll a great stone unto me this day. So Saul built an altar to the Lord because, you know, he had been, his word had been, they'd gone against his word. In fact, what it did was cause them to sin even more. It was really a sin in Israel to eat meat with blood. Now, probably that was a health matter in those days when they didn't have refrigeration. Anyway, the people were not supposed to eat meat with blood. And it makes a special issue of it here because it says the people took the calves and slew them on the ground and the people did eat them with the blood. So then they told Saul, saying, Behold, the people sin against the Lord in that they eat with the blood. And he said, You have transgressed. Roll a great stone unto me this day. Now, I wanted to bring that out in one sense, because whereas in a way Saul was radical, in the beginning days he was very sensitive to this sort of thing. And he was actually concerned about that problem. And he said, You people sinned against the Lord. And so he said, Disperse yourselves among the people, say unto them, bring me hither every man and his ox, and every man his sheep, and slay them here, and eat, and sin not against the Lord in eating with the blood. And all the people brought every man his ox with him that night, and slew them there. And Saul built an altar unto the Lord, and the same was the first altar that he built unto the Lord. So Saul was very zealous about all of this, you see. And Saul said, Let us go down after the Philistines by night and spoil them until the morning light, and let us not leave a man of them alive. And they said, Do whatsoever seemeth good. And so then Saul asked counsel of God, Shall I go down after the Philistines? Wilt thou deliver them? But he answered him, Not that day. So Saul said, Draw ye near hither as the chief of all the people, and know and see wherein this sin hath been this day. For as the Lord liveth, which saveth Israel, though it be even in Jonathan my son, he shall surely die. But there was not a man among all the people to answer him. They all knew it was Jonathan that had... You see, really, it was not that God said Jonathan sinned. It was that Saul set that up. Now, as far as the blood was concerned, that was taken care of with the sacrifice. And just because God did not answer Saul immediately didn't mean that he had a case against Jonathan, but God had a case, but Saul did. So Saul is very zealous, and he said, Even if it's my own son, he's disobeyed this rule, I'm going to kill him. So then he said to all the people, Be ye on my side, and I and Jonathan my son will be on the other side. The people said to Saul, Do what seemeth good to thee. So then Saul said, Well, we'll cast lots, which they did, and ultimately the lot fell to Jonathan. Saul said to Jonathan, Tell me what you have done. And Jonathan said, I did but taste a little honey with the end of the rod that was in mine hand, and lo, I must die. And Saul answered, God do so and more also, for thou shalt surely die, Jonathan. Now here's a fellow whose whole life was covered with problems, and he's going to slay his son over this infraction of the rule. Now, God never told Saul to slay Jonathan. Saul, as I said, was very zealous. And there's a peril in that, as we shall see. So then the people said to Saul, Shall Jonathan die who hath wrought this great salvation in Israel? Because Jonathan led the hosts in the slaughter of the Philistines. And they said, God forbid, as the Lord liveth, there shall not one hair of his head fall to the ground, for he hath wrought with God this day. So the people rescued Jonathan, that he died not. Here's a really good, it isn't an allegory, it's an actual history, but it's a good object lesson. Because Saul took more to himself than he had a right to take. This is a common problem among leaders today. Take people, one of the classic examples, of course, is Jones down in Guyana, where he took to himself more authority than he had the right to take. And it wasn't just that, it wasn't that he was the representative of God's authority. He had long ago lost that. He started out with a pretty straight deal, but he did not get the education he needed, and he began to be taken over with what we call megalomania. Whenever ministers start dictating outside the terms of the Bible, then they're in trouble. They better watch out. I said in a group last Wednesday and Thursday night, and we had some various people, Roman Catholics, quite a few of them, maybe half the group were. But I said, you know, my job is to do the best I can to tell you what the Bible says. I don't have anything outside of that. If other people figure out different teachings and so forth, that's their problem. My job is to talk about the Bible. Now, of course, the Roman Church has many, many traditions in it. And I said, I have no comment about it. That's up to them. If they figure they want to do that, that's fine. But I said, I'm not going to debate that. What I have to give you is the Bible. Now, pastors who stay with that and just keep their nose to the book will get along better. But they begin to branch out and take traditional ideas and their own personal ideas and things the Bible doesn't really lay on people. See, for example, a fellow may assume that because he's in the ministry, he has to use his mind to develop all the programs needed to build a great church. And so he puts programs in there that are not biblical necessarily, and then he becomes a sort of a czar ruling over the people, and assuming that because this particular person is not in there pushing, you know, he's not serving the Lord because he's not coming to the calling programs and all that kind of stuff. So they get off into a lot of teachings that are not strictly biblical. They may be implied ideas, but they're not biblical. That's something a man has to be very careful about in leadership, of taking too much authority to himself, because he has no authority outside the Bible. It's something that even husbands have to watch out for, who have a certain amount of authority given them by the Scripture, that they, and I make this a very clear point in the wedding services, as some of you have found out, that the husband has got to come as a representative of Christ in his headship. And if he takes too much authority to himself and comes in his own name, he's liable to make mistakes. But the same is even more true for pastors who have the responsibility of the people. A man has to be responsible for what he says. One of my concerns about the electronic church, so to speak, is that the people who are leaders there do not have to be responsible. I mean, they have no responsibility for the outcome of their ministry, because they say any cockamamie thing they want, and they're not ever called to face the people to whom they say this. You see? That's why a lot of pastors aren't very good at counseling, because they're forced to face the reality of what they've been saying from the pulpit. It doesn't always work in daily life. This is a very important point, that Saul got too big for his britches, as the saying goes. He was going beyond his capacity. But the net result of that was to bring grief to himself, because he was taking too much authority. On the other hand, you see, he caused the people to sin. That's another important point. When a minister lays too heavy a load on a people, too many restrictions, the tendency is for them to break loose. And there's also a tendency not only to break loose, but also to get discouraged. If you keep going to church and every Sunday you find that you're not still not living up to what you're supposed to be doing, it gets discouraging. Instead of giving comfort and encouragement, often the ministry is all on the other side as the pastor tries to put leverage on people to get them to fulfill a program. That causes a lot of problems, because people then go the other way. Just like these people, they were caused to sin. Had they been allowed to go ahead and eat the honey or eat the food that they had, it would have strengthened them. They would have been able to do battle, and they would have not have gone off into this orgiastic escapade when they finally did break over. So anyway, the people had more sense than Saul here, and they intervened to save Jonathan's life. Well, then it says that, but the matter passed, you see. Saul took the kingdom over Israel and fought against all his enemies on every side, against Moab, against the children of Ammon, and against Edom, against the kings of Zobah, and against the Philistines. And whithersoever he turned himself, he vexed them, and gathered an host, and smote the Amalekites, and delivered Israel out of the hands of them that spoiled them. Saul was a very effective leader of the people, and if he had not gotten off into this sidetrack, he'd have probably remained a very good king over Israel. Now, Samuel, they were going up against the Amalekites. That is a very, very important point here, because Samuel said to Saul to go and smite Amalek and utterly destroy all that they have and spare them not, but slay both man and woman, infant and suckling, ox and sheep, camel and ass. Now that sounds very, very brutish. But there was a bad seed there in the Amalekites. First of all, I want to say this. In God's view, death is not the ultimate evil, the ultimate terror. Because if people relate to him in their spirits, death merely springs them loose from this wretched place into eternal bliss. So it's not anything to be feared. So God doesn't look on death as the ultimate terror. Edgar Allan Poe did. All of his stuff is macabre. And if you ever read much of Edgar Allan Poe, you probably want to keep your light on at night, because it gets pretty gruesome. But he was always obsessed with this idea of death. In fact, Poe was so obsessed with the idea of being buried alive that he had a special tomb built, rigged up with levers and so forth that he could get from his coffin, and food was to be placed around and so forth. He wanted to make sure if they buried him alive, he'd be able to get out. Unfortunately, he did some traveling, and one time he was traveling on a ship, and he had this lower berth, and he woke up in the night, and of course those berths, especially those days, are very tiny. They are today, but these were even tiny. And he's in this wood case, and he's banging on the bunk above him, and he thinks he's in a coffin, so he really scared him witless. Not that he wasn't witless already. As old James Russell Lowell observed in a poem of his, "Here comes Poe like Barnaby Rudge, two-fifth genius and three-fifth sheer fudge." So old Edgar Allan Poe was full of fudge. But he was obsessed with this idea of being very alive. No, he had reason, because he was had a disease in those days that would emulate death. You know, because all of his bodily functions would not be noticeable, but it was like a fit. You know, he had like epilepsy or something, and he would come out of it. But he was always afraid that when he was away from home, he would go into one of those fits and then they'd bury him alive. That's why a lot of his stories are like that. They're some terrible stories. They're laughable if you have any sense of humor about the matter of death. God is not himself obsessed with terror of death. For him to say, slay the women and children, you may say, well, what did they do to deserve that? Well, you can ask it the other way. What did they deserve to have to live with the brutish men that they were married to? For many people, death would be a welcome release. After all, life in those days was not all that choice, unless you were in the higher echelons of the monarchy or something, but the common man in those days lived a pretty brutish, simple life. There was nothing to cling to life. They weren't having parties every Saturday night and going out to the local ice cream joint or something. Life was pretty barren and grueling for most peoples. But for God to save the world by death is not all that far off. People get, you see, without Christ, people get a lot of kookamania ideas, you see. I happened to get in on a television show. This canister or small cylinder of a very dangerous virus, a lethal dose of virus, had been stolen, or pardon me, was being transported on a plane to some locale in South America, and some hijackers happened to hijack that plane. And this little cylinder was in a cigar case. And so one of the hijackers wanted the cigar, and he took it and put it in his pocket. Well, when the negotiations were coming down about the hostages, the agents of the government, U.S. government, CIA or whatever they were at that time, OSS, the agents of the federal government knew the situation, and they knew that virus, that canister, unless they totally destroyed it, could wipe out a population, maybe a whole country, the way it was set up. Well, they had this do-gooder that was aghast at the thought that the federal government would not be more concerned about the hostages than about that tube, you see. And they wanted to be sure all the hostages remained alive. The federal agents were, the big thing to them was destroy that thing before it destroyed populations. Now, this fellow just succeeded in lousing the whole thing up grandly, his do-gooder attitude about things. And finally, I guess they got the cylinder destroyed, but had it, this guy might have loused up the whole thing and released that virus and wiped out a population. Now, the simple point is, of course, that God has ideas about life far different than we do. And if he had to wipe out the population of Canaan in order to secure the rest of the world from that evil virus, then he was going to do that. But the death was not so bad in God's eyes, inasmuch as he knew of, that the death was only a temporary thing. That's why I've said to people today, don't worry so much about dying. Worry about, concern yourself about getting the spirit into your life. And be concerned about the spirit factor, because the rest of it is a tale told by an idiot anyway. Life, you know, one foot on a banana peel and the other in a grave. So God sees things a lot differently. And so when Samuel said to Saul, I want you to slay all of the Amalekites, man, woman, and child, and the oxen even, the cattle, everything. Now, in the genetics of the day, we have to more and more realize the presence of traits and genes that are pretty powerful in the directing of a given person's psyche. A lot of the behavior problems we have are genetic. There are people born with streaks in them that are just really very antisocial. For example, one of the more prominent and obvious illustrations of this is the autistic child. I've mentioned to you before, but the autistic child is one that is so self-oriented that their behavior patterns may move in the direction either of very antisocial behavior. That kind of kid can just make life miserable for anybody around him. Of course, there are some that we may think they're doing it anyway, but this is a very serious vein. And or they may go the other route and be totally withdrawn, crouch in a corner, totally inward. That's an autistic child. So genes can carry some very unwholesome traits. Now, the Lord allows us to begin life with a package. That package may have in it some negative factors that may cause us problems down the line. People, for example, one of the common issues is alcoholism. There's a vast difference between the social drinker and the alcoholic. Social drinker may get into such a habit of liquor, and it may be an addictive kind of thing, but it is it's not a craving in the same sense that the alcoholic is. We have a biochemical pattern. Chemicals in certain levels in our system vary considerably. And if you had a perfect balance of all these chemicals, they could be diagrammed like a wheel with all the spokes equal in length, and there would be 31 of these spokes. That's the basic number of chemicals in the body. Now, they have discovered that the saliva of alcoholics has five chemicals in it that are similar in levels. And that's just very basic research, but so much has been done on the subject that it becomes obvious that a person can have an alcoholic tendency. So what we know is that the passing on, the transmitting of negative factors in the personality through genetics is very common and very strong. Now, what I'm saying to you is, as Christians, we may have certain weaknesses, areas of weakness, but that doesn't mean we have to indulge them, you see. It may be strong within us. People may be prone to temper loss, lack of control. That doesn't mean they have to go around doing that. It's behavior that is negative of value and destructive and self-destructive. And while it may be a problem for people to control it, we have to take the package we've been given and do the best we can with that package, and not assume that everyone who becomes a Christian must immediately have a totally restored biochemical pattern and everything should be just hunky-dory for everybody who's become a Christian. It just isn't that way. But we have patterns of behavior that can be very self-destructive, and it is advisable to control it, that's all. It's like, you know, some of these things we seem very enticing, but I've often said to groups of young men and so forth, if you think in terms, let's say, of a French pastry, and you look at that, it is so enticing, and the icing and the design and so forth looks so, as the girls say, so yummy, you know. It looks just so enticing. Now, let's assume that you knew that not only was it not really the best to eat, not really wholesome, it's got too much sugar and stuff in it, but let us assume you know that it also has in it, the cake has been spiked with LSD. Now, LSD might blow your brains. A lot of young people wound up in the mental institutions. I visited them there, and they're just wacko. And yet, you know, one day they're fine, and then the next day they take a little dose of LSD. Well, that can happen to some people with the first dose. Some people can take 50 doses and not affect them, and the 51st will blow their brain. What I'm saying is, let us assume that now you happen to have it on good authority that someone has put LSD in the cake or the punch. But it looks so good, so enticing. It's your favorite cake. And you can't resist it, but you know it's got LSD in it. All right, so what are you going to do? You say, well, it's just so nice, I can't resist it. Crunch, munch, and there you go. You may blow your brain. All of life's a risk, we know that. But the point is, if you have areas of weakness, and things may entice you, just like alcohol, it's so enticing. But if you know it's going to poison you, you just shouldn't take it any more than you would take a piece of cake that had been poisoned or spiked with LSD or something. And you knew it was bad. You knew it was wrong for you, hurtful. But you do it anyway. Well, that's one of the problems of human life. But I'm just saying to you, the fact that people have weaknesses in this life from genetic strains, they may, you can say, well, I understand it, as I've had to say to people, what, I understand it. I understand why you behave that way, but that doesn't make it any better for you. That doesn't resolve the consequences of that behavior. And one may say, well, that's just too harsh a discipline. And no, it's just a way of life. You take a bite of the LSD and you get kicked in the head, as it were. That's like Russian roulette. It may not get kicked in the head. This is just the way life is. Well, in the process of things, these factors where the Lord requested the total destruction of that seed of the Amalekites, because if there were any intermarriage, the seed would be carried on. Now, I don't know why he wanted also the animals slain, but whatever it was, Amalek represented satanic force in the world. And if that satanic force informed or invested all the people, that's one thing. But it would not be surprising to me, given the Lord's command, that it might have invested also the animals and people eating the animals. Now, this is in patterns of genetics that are beyond us at the present time. And any geneticist in the business would totally disclaim any connection between animals that have had faulty genetic patterns or faulty factors in them, that it would affect the behavior patterns of the people who eat those animals. And I don't know that that has any scientific validity at all, but I can say that given God's attitude here, it is possible that at least if some satanic force had invaded that whole civilization, including the animals, God wanted them destroyed. Now, Saul had a bright idea here, which I will talk about next week. Saul's bright idea. All right, we better pray. Father, we ask you to help us in the understanding of these things. And they do go beyond us often and beyond our strength, of course. We ask the Spirit will strengthen us to do what he says and to live as he wants us on the earth. In Christ's name, amen.